But first today, you know that old phrase people used to say to each other, it's like death and taxes always with us. Well, many of us now include offshore money laundering, death, taxes and offshore money laundering as a third part of a trifecta that can't be avoided, no matter how much we'd like to. Whether via the Panama Papers or extraordinary details of the home interiors of, say, the ex-Prime Minister of Malaysia and his wife, we have been exposed to some specifics of the obscene wealth garnered by certain people. The scale of wealth sitting outside the countries where it was first generated is truly enough to make one gasp, and we'll hear the details shortly. An epidemic, really, of grasping and greed. But it turns out the invention of offshore finance does have a beginning during the 1960s, roughly. There are genuine efforts to rein it in now, with more than 100 countries signing up to something called the CRS, the Common Reporting Standard, where information swapped on account holders for taxation purposes. Investigative journalist Oliver Bullough's new book is called Moneyland, and it tries to unravel part of this giant web. When did the growth of the super wealthy really begin to take shape?
I think, yeah, like you say, everyone just tends to think that offshore finance and tax evasion and all that is just one of these things you have to live with, you know, and the fact that, you know, the ruling families of the Philippines or Ukraine or Russia or Nigeria
Malaysia.
Or whatever have all Malaysia, I mean, you know, you name it, they do it all pretty much, have pretty much always, you know, stolen money from their peoples and just spent it on yachts and fast cars in London and Sydney and Vancouver and New York or wherever. But actually, that's not the case. I mean, I think officials have probably always stolen from the people they rule. But essentially, you know, if 60, 70 years ago, if you stole money, I mean, you could steal it, put it in a hole in the ground, but that was more or less all you could do with it. You couldn't really enjoy it properly. It wasn't something you could spend on high-end property in West London or wherever. But it was this invention of offshore finance, which was a sort of joint venture between bankers in the City of London and bankers in Switzerland who found a sort of common cause. The Swiss had been stashing money and the London bankers wanted something to do because they were a bit bored after the war when nothing was going on. And they invented this offshore finance, which basically meant that it wasn't, you didn't need to put money in a hole in the ground anymore. You could steal it, stash it, and then miraculously they liberated it. They set it free and then you could spend it.
Well, I just want to do a little more of this because it really helped me, I have to say, to thread my way through and I suppose stop me being despairing, actually, that in effect your money stayed where you had acquired it. And this really worked partly because of the Bretton Woods Agreement post-war, which set up really the financial system of the post-war world. And then it was a banker called Sigmund Warburg, who had actually been in Hitler's Germany, who started forcing his way, as you put it, through the Bretton Woods regulations, and not until the sort of late 60s, early 70s. And I did not understand until you made it clear to me how this helped the City of London. I always knew about Switzerland, but not the City of London's role in this.
I mean, the Bretton Woods institutions are kind of not really remembered very much today, but they were an amazing attempt at the end of the Second World War, this sort of glorious utopian attempt to sort of try and re-engineer how the world worked, to say we're going to stop money bossing governments around, that democracy is going to be on top and money will always be subservient to democracy. And it was amazing. And it led to sort of 2.5 decades of uninterrupted growth. When people talk about a word in the 1960s, great, it's Bretton Woods that they're talking about. This is what created growing equality, growing prosperity. There was no global recessions for 2.5 decades. They were amazing. But the problem was that it stopped money moving. And that meant the City of London was out of a job because moving money was what the City of London did. And Sigmund Warburg, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany, had set himself up in London, was a real, you know, a real hustler, a very, very good banker, but kind of outside the city establishment. He was very frustrated by this because he could see what business use had been like before, and he wanted to get back into that game again. And so he got a couple of his best guys in 1962-3 and basically told them to find a way to get this money that had been stashed in Switzerland by tax dodgers and, you know, and kleptocrats, to get that money and package it up and lend it out, because that would get the city back in business. I mean, it's amazing what they did. If you just look at it dispassionately, it's an astonishing achievement. But it was, you know, the invention that broke the world. It was called the Eurobond. It's essentially, it means that the opportunity for a corrupt official is just exponentially greater than it ever was, which is why there are so many corrupt officials.
So it's made respectable, effectively. And so we've now, and the scale of what this has led to is, for instance, 52%. The French economist Gabriel Zucman estimates 52% of Russian household wealth is now offshore.
Well, I mean, it's Russia is particularly badly affected by this, but on a global level, we're talking about between 8 and 10% of all the money anywhere in the world is offshore. It's hidden. It's anonymously owned. And offshore isn't a place, by the way. It's not the British Virgin Islands or Hong Kong or whatever. Offshore just means not here, elsewhere. It's a legal construct that essentially means something can hide without being anywhere in particular.
And that's your whole idea of moneyland. That's your lovely generic term.
That's moneyland. And I invented moneyland to try and get my own head around this problem, basically. And moneyland, if you look at its economy, it's the third biggest economy in the world after America and China. It's absolutely massive.
Is that true? Is that right?
But if it's 8 and 10% of all the money in the world, yes, that's right. And in fact, that's a relatively conservative estimate. Some people say it's much more than that. And yeah, the sort of the world capital of moneyland is probably London or I mean, New York is a constant competitor because it's wherever the money goes, that's where, you know, moneyland is. But let's say, I mean, we're all guilty to a lesser or greater extent. We all like this money in the rich countries. We like it. We want it to come in and invest in our property market and our bonds and so on. So, you know, Sydney has been very favored by certain classes of moneylanders, Miami by others, Vancouver by others. Basically, money is stolen from poor and unstable countries. It's laundered in offshore jurisdictions, whether that's the British Virgin Islands or Hong Kong or wherever. And it's spent in a small number of wealthy, stable countries. It's a sort of is a constant flow of money from the people who actually need it to the people who really don't.
I mean, some of the examples, at independence in 1991 in the Ukraine, everyone in the country, you write, owned roughly the same amount of stuff. 2 decades later, by 2013, just 45 individuals owned assets equal in value to half the country's economy. And they needed the services and participation, this is what is so devastating, of other countries, like British shell companies, for instance. So, you know, Transparency International has Britain in its honest list at number 10, and Ukraine is actually number 131, but they are linked, you say.
Well, that's right. I mean, we think of corruption as something that happens in a country, whether that country is, you know, Equatorial Guinea or that country is New Zealand, you know, and we think, well, Equatorial Guinea is dodgy and New Zealand is clean. But actually, corruption doesn't work like that at all. It's always transnational. The money is stolen in a poor country almost invariably, and it's laundered in a sort of small country almost invariably, and it's hidden in a rich country. But every single one of those stages is required to steal the money. So this idea that corruption is something like, you know, a football league that stays within a country, you know, that it's totally wrong. It's actually harmful to our understanding of what's really going on to look at the world that way. I mean, you know, that statistic about, you know, the inequality in Ukraine is an astonishing one, but the statistics sort of globally, you know, according to Oxfam, the top 3.5 dozen people in the world this year owned the same amount of stuff as the bottom 3.5 billion people in the world. You know, and this is a result of moneyland. Its inequality is rising so fast because if you steal money or just obtain it anywhere you like, you stash it in moneyland and it's safe forever.
And of course, it was actually encountering President Yanukovych's toilet facilities. You've just got to explain to listeners what that's all about, which sort of fully triggered this effort by you to understand what was going on.
It was, I mean, it's weird. I'm not quite sure why it was his toilets, because I'd seen all this astonishing sort of swag that he'd accumulated, his palace. He had a 5-story log cabin. You know, his garage was just full of treasure. He had a Picasso ceramic in the garage. He had a paperweight in the garage that used to belong to Stalin that no one knows how he got. It's just the amount of stuff was extraordinary. But then, yeah, I was wandering around his hunting lodge, which makes it sound rather more rustic than it was. It was a very lovely, you know, facility indeed. And I walked into his ensuite bathroom, and he had a huge flat screen television on the wall in the toilet at sitting down height. It was for watching while on the loo, and it was that moment when I realized what sort of grotesque character he was, and how was it possible that the country had let him get away with this. And I said to my friend Anton, who was showing me around, he was a revolutionary, I said, how did you let him get away with this? And then he sort of exploded at me and said, look, this place isn't even in Ukraine, it's in England. And I didn't really understand what he meant, but I looked up the ownership sort of data for the place where we were, and he was right. The ownership of this hunting lodge was hidden. Ukrainians couldn't find out who owned it because it was owned by shell companies in London and then another shell company eventually in Liechtenstein. It was in Moneyland. And once I'd had that sort of flash of insight, I realized that that's where everything is. It's not just Ukrainian toilets. It's half the Ukrainian economy or more. It's half the Russian economy. It's half the sub-Saharan African economy.
And maybe things are shifting, like we've just been hearing how the British government, as I think of May of this year, have started bringing in altogether more stringent regulations. And I think people like Roman Abramovich cannot get back into England, the owner of Chelsea, because they won't give him a visa. And there's allegedly something like 38 Russian billionaires who are affected by this. So, and this has clearly been revved up by the whole Skripal drama. So, is there a sense that things are shifting in the right way?
I mean, I think there is more awareness now of what's really happening. I think for a long time this has been happening and we've all been content to let it happen because the people that mattered were making money from it and no one else knew. That isn't really the case anymore. I think the damage that is being done by this is now more and more visible and more obvious. But we are very, very far behind the curve in terms of dealing with this. And essentially the reason for that is that the basic dynamic of Moneyland is that money goes wherever it likes. Money is borderless, but laws have to stop at borders. So if you own money, you can put it wherever it will be best treated. So if, say, Britain decides tomorrow, and let's face it, this isn't going to happen, but if Britain decided tomorrow that it would crack down, that it would essentially impose all the laws that me and the sort of other people who go on about this stuff would like it to do, would do the checks people wanted it to do, to give the police the money they need to do their job, and all these things that would be, if tomorrow if that happened, the money could just go to America or could just go to France or go to wherever. So it's a global problem that requires a global solution. And this is one of the reasons why so things like the election of Donald Trump or Brexit or whatever are so difficult for me, because these national solutions to an international problem don't get at the root of what's going on, which is that this is a transnational issue.
And Oliver Bullough's book, Bullough, it's Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. It's published by Profile Books, and I was surprised how much interest it garnered in Saturday Extra listeners. It was quite gratifying, really, to hear.